welcome to today's podcast, the first in the series titled Handle with Care, Part 3. Life wasn't created at a whim, nor should it be lived that way. This podcast is taken from the Sunday message. It is designed to strengthen the believer's walk and those who have not come to faith to recognize God has designed life to be lived with purpose. I am Pastor David, the assistant pastor at Bethel Gilead Community Church, also known as the Church on Block Road. Here is Pastor Jim with this week's message, Radical Environmentalism and Population Control.
Back in about 2016, 2017, somewhere in there, you know, they all run together, don't they, at a certain point. Kim and I were in South Carolina. We actually went there to perform a wedding, Julian Ransom's wedding. Was it Julian Ransom who was getting married there? Carissa and Ryan's wedding down in Savannah. Thank you. But we decided to stop in at the haunts of my wife's old haunts at Pawleys Island a couple of days ahead of schedule just to enjoy some downtime. And we were staying there at the historic Pelican Inn. The historic Pelican Inn, if you're ever down there. Look it up on Pawleys Island. And it just so happened one of the mornings that we were there, we had breakfast with this distinguished couple, both of them PhDs, professors, the university in North Carolina, actually at Appalachian State. I think she taught English. I think he maybe taught chemistry or physics, something to the effect. And it was an interesting conversation, if you can imagine, Kim and I. We're fairly educated, but boy, not highly educated like these people, trying to carry on a conversation. And so we went through the usual cordialities, you know, and when it got to family, they had no kids. They were pretty much dedicated to their profession, which I thought was laudable. But the conversation turned to us, and my wife broke it to them in careful terms. Well, we have 8 kids. And this highly intelligent man looked at me and, with sincerity in his eyes, asked me one of the stupidest questions I've ever been asked. He said, "Did you intend to have that many kids?" Said, "No, it was an accident. I mean, did you intend to have that many kids?" Now, you got to read behind the lines. There was a dramatic difference of worldviews between that couple and Kim and I. Not in terms of education, but in terms of what we held dear within our hearts, our core beliefs about life and living. And in their mind, they were thinking, imagine the carbon footprint this family is producing. The weight on society. Why bring so many kids into such a troubled world? Now, that is, in fact, representative of what a large percentage of the people in this world either believe or are coming to believe. Last week from 1 Chronicles 12:32, I introduced this series. We're talking about hot potato cultural issues that we need to handle with care. And I suggested we need the men of Issachar to return to Branch County and to help us to know what the times are about. These were men that understood the times, we're told, but they also knew what Israel should do. And so therein lies our assignment here to discern, to decipher, what are the times that we're living in? And as believers in God, followers of Christ, what should we do? This morning, I'd like to pick up with what I think is a hot-button topic, and I hinted to it there in that little conversation we had with that couple from North Carolina. I'd like to expound on. I feel like I'm taking a drink out of a fire hose, if you've ever tried to do that. It's impossible. There's so much here. But stay with me. I'm going to speak at 150 words per minute with gusts up to 180, so you're going to have to listen quick, if you would. You've got an outline in your bulletins. I'd suggest that you follow it because we're going to be referring to dates. We're going to take a timeline. We're going to look at some statistics, And then we're going to try to bring our faith, as always, into play. And an issue that I think is pertinent to all of us, radical environmentalism and population control. Radical environmentalism, 1974, 75, I was a 7th and 8th grader. I remember 7th and 8th grade science in the mid-70s. Ecology was the theme. Ecology was big back then. Big emphasis on the depletion of our natural resources of the earth as the population swelled. Big emphasis on pollution. It was a problem and still is today. Air pollution, water pollution, land pollution back in the 70s. Since then, we've added noise pollution. We've added light pollution. And now we're being told incessantly that we are polluting the climate, if that's possible. Climate pollution. The problem of pollution is really a problem of people. It's the common denominator in air pollution, water pollution, land pollution. It's people. And the more people, the more pollution. But the inverse follows. The less people, the less pollution. You want to deal with pollution? You got to deal with people. You got to deal with populations or the problem of overpopulation. Now, let me take you for a journey here. Let's go all the way back to 1798. And I want to introduce what has been known as the Malthusian Dilemma. Thomas Malthus, an English clergyman, a mathematician, was at a lecture given by Benjamin Franklin there in England. And Franklin was expounding on the American colonies and all that was happening there. And he made a statement that stunned Malthus. He suggested that they were experiencing some 3% growth in the colonies each year. Malthus, who was a mathematician along with a clergyman, began to do the math, and he realized that means every 23 years the colonies will duplicate. And it troubled him so to consider the possibility that the earth is multiplying so fast. And according to his calculations, we would be overpopulated by the year 1890, some 100 years after he heard Franklin speak. Posited what is called the Malthusian delusion. And we see it yet today in every direction that we turn. Let's track this delusion or this dilemma just through the last 70 years or so. 1952, John D. Rockefeller III became concerned about the swelling populations within the nations of the world, partly influenced by Margaret Sanger, who I'll introduce in a little bit. He determined that he needed to invest big time in this world problem. And so he created at the time what became known as the Population Council. And he hired an army of population experts, set up population clinics all over the world, India, Egypt, Malaysia, China, Africa, all with the goal to bring contraception and, where possible, sterilization to the poor masses in those faraway places. 1958, Dwight D. Eisenhower appointed William Draper as chair of a committee that would study this topic of foreign aid and what the United States should do financially to assist foreign nations, foreign aid. What he produced is called the Draper Report. He endorsed population control as a primary tool, notice this, for halting the spread of communism. Communism, of all things, which Draper suggested could reproduce easily in faraway places, swelling populations, ignorance and poverty abounding. It's where communism would most likely take root. Best thing that we can do is control those populations now. 1966, the government established the Agency for International Development, the Agency for International Development, known today as USAID. USAID. And from that, the Office of Population was developed, and a man named Rimmert Ravenhold, a medical doctor, who became known as a population czar back in the 60s and the 70s and even into the 80s, Dr. Rimmert Ravenhold. And his theory, his stated goal, was that we needed to stop poor women from having too many children. Now, that's quoted, too many children. How many is too many? And Ravenhold saw pregnancy as a disease. Now, that shouldn't shock you, because many people do today. He saw pregnancy as a disease, and the cure was contraception, was abortion, or better still, sterilization were the cures to that dilemma, that terrible dilemma of pregnancy. His theory, if children are not eliminated in the womb, they will grow up to eliminate one another in the streets. This is a government agent of the United States of America back in the 1960s, taking tax dollars, putting them to use in faraway places, oftentimes in terrible ways. In the subsequent 25 years, Ravenhold and his agency spent some $1.5 billion on birth control drugs and devices. To date, to this day, the USAID program has spent over $8 billion on what they, I think, wrongly tabulate as reproductive health. It's not reproduction in that case, it's deproduction, isn't it? All overseas and overseas programs. 1968, a man named Paul Ehrlich wrote a book, became a bestseller. Maybe you read it. It was called The Population Bomb. And in that book, Paul Ehrlich postulated that under the present circumstances in the United States and other places, that as a result of the birth rates, the population would ultimately fill the earth, and not as Malthus determined in some 100 years, but in 15 to 20 years, mid-70s to the mid-80s at best. That was a huge scare tactic. It was a great seller. The problem is his predictions fell far short, didn't they? 1970, we celebrated in the United States the first Earth Day. Anybody remember Earth Days? Still celebrated, as a matter of fact. The slogan, basically, of Earth Day is simply this: save the Earth. Save the Earth. Do what you can, what you must, which I'm going to suggest has much to do with reproduction and birth control. 1971, the German Klaus Schwab established what is known today as the World Economic Forum. Have you heard of it? It's an international organization of public and private agencies located in Geneva, Switzerland. The WEF progressively seeks to alter the course of world nations economically, politically, environmentally. One of their primary emphases is on developing populations and population control. Recent corona crisis, Klaus Schwab has suggested that the world needs more than ever a great, can you finish the sentence? Reset. It's the book that he wrote. It is the driving force of the World Economic Forum today. 1974, the United Nations held what they consider to be a world population conference in Bucharest, Romania. Some 135 nations were represented and came to a consensus that there are too many people on planet Earth and that major efforts must be made to alter social and economic development of developing countries in a way that populations are limited. 1988, the UN carried out what they called the climate change. The International Panel on Climate Change was the first that suggested that climate change is largely related to the population, as I did earlier, and that it must be dealt with significantly. Like the Rockefellers, There were ground-based organizations that developed about this time in the 80s and 90s, foundations that arose, all with great concern in knowing how can we limit the population of these budding, growing, oftentimes poor nations. For example, 1991, the Bill and Linda Gates Foundation, later the Clinton Foundation. In 2005, both stated objectives of fighting poverty, disease, and inequity around the world, all which I would say are good things, aren't they? But all which, in their opinion, are outgrowths of the basic problem of overpopulation. Both groups are very influential in governments and government agencies today, primarily because they wield so much money. They manage so much money. The Clinton Global Initiative has divvied out some $70 million, and in the last number of years has raised over $2 billion for social action programs. Social action programs abroad. In fact, they were the first, I think, to come up with the slogan, Build Back Better. Came out of the devastation of Haiti after several hurricanes here 10 or 12 years ago, I think it was. And now it has been adopted widely as the theme, boy, of the World Economic Forum as well as so many others, Build Back Better. Now, speaking to this modern Malthusian dilemma, philosopher David Benatar wrote a book called Better Never to Have Been here not so long ago. And in it, he promoted a philosophy of what's called antinatalism. Anti, it's against natal birth. With the premise that giving birth in today's world is immoral. It's wrong. It's unresponsible to bring children into this world. Why? And he states three basic premises. Because humanity is the world's number one problem. Why bring more people in and create more problems? All the crime, injustice, pain, and disease can be posited with people. And to give birth to more people, to bring more people into the world, is only to extend the world's problems. Secondly, he suggested, because the planet cannot survive if more humans, or if we continue to propagate humanity. And then finally, he said, why subject a child to a life of misery, pain, and suffering? I mean, some of you have actually wrestled with that question, haven't you, as you've considered having children. What kind of world am I bringing this kid into? What kind of future could this kid face? Do you sense that? And you hear the urgency of some of these people's positions. As radical as they are, they sincerely believe that this is the direction of the world and what ought to be done to curb, to stall that. Save the world. Recent UN conference on population. 20,000 scientists. Now, scientists in quotations here, because as they reviewed the list, they found that many of those people were not scientists. In fact, perhaps most of them were students of science at the time. But some 20,000 signatures from a document warning humanity of the destruction that is on the horizon if we continue on our course. Their call was for immediate action, including drastically lowering the world's population, Ceasing to eat meat was another one. For those of you who are here at the hog roast, this may be the last year we're able to do that. The good news is on the horizon is synthetic meat. We have yet to try that out, don't we, on the grill. Was another stated suggestion of these 20,000 scientists, subsisting the use of fossil fuels. You see that one coming with electric cars, as well as wood products and air travel, and finally, obviously, carbon emissions. If not, these signees suggest we are doomed as a planet. Well, how bad is it, actually? We can look at the statistics, and they are awesome. They really are, if you follow this line of thought. 1927, there were some 2 billion people on planet Earth. 1960, there were 3 billion, almost 30 years after. From 1960 to 1974, we added a fourth billion. 1987, 5 billion. From 1990 to 1999, some 6 billion. 2011, there were 7 billion people estimated on planet Earth. Now by 2023, next year, we are expected to reach 8 billion people. By 2050, the calculations at this course are some 10 billion citizens of Earth. It is estimated that we add some 200,000 people a day to planet Earth. Over 60% of those people, interestingly enough, live in megacities, in cities around the world. Top 10 cities on Earth, Tokyo, some 37 million citizens of Tokyo. Have you been there? Delhi, 30 million. Shanghai, 27 million. Sao Paulo, Brazil, 22 million. Mexico City, 22 million people. Dhaka, 21. Cairo, 21. Beijing, 20 million people. Bombay, 20 million people. Osaka, 19 million people. That's the top 10 cities of the world. New York City didn't make the list, unfortunately. They're working on it. Actually, I think just the opposite. But New York City is just shy of the 10th largest city in the world. It's number 11 at this point. New York City with some 18 million people, which tops the cities in the U.S., obviously New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, Houston, Phoenix, good old Detroit. Boy, we're lagging behind. We're number 27, but they're working on it over there as well, as far as the largest cities in the United States. Interestingly, though, some of those cities aren't the most overcrowded. If you go by density of people per square mile, most of those cities don't figure because they're so expansive in terms of their land space, overcrowding within the cities. Detroit, some 1,200 people per square mile. That sounds like a lot, but Paris has 54,000 people per square mile. Talk about shoulder to shoulder, getting on a subway or a bus. It is the most crowded, one of the most crowded cities in the world. It's not the most crowded. Western New York City, some 49,000 people per square mile. Mexico City, some 22,000 people per square mile. But it's Manila, the world leader, is the most crowded place on Earth, with 111,000 people per square mile on the streets of Manila. Now, if you were to take the world's population and you were to place them in the state of Texas, how many of you have driven across Texas? That's a forever drive, isn't it? The one state. We could take the world's population and according to the number of people on Earth and the square mileage of Texas, you would place people approximately 100 feet apart from one another. Each person could have 1,000 square feet of space within the span of the state of Texas, to give you a sense of how many people and geographically how they could fit or where they could fit. All this brings us to this concern of what do we do about the growing numbers of people? If people are the problem, and the radical environmentalists are saying we cannot solve these environmental problems without solving a more grievous problem, which is the growth of populations. Therefore, we need to enact severe measures of population control on planet Earth. What does this movement look like? In point two there, I'm going to suggest to you, it begins with, in our case, Charles Darwin, who wrote a book that became a classic, referred to routinely in classrooms around the world, The Origin of the Species. But that's not really the title of the book. That's a subtitle of the book. The full title of Charles Darwin's book from 1859 is The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or, if you don't like that, The Favored Races. The Favored Races? In the struggle for life, where he posits that basic biological principle, the survival of the fittest or the fattest, the survival of the fastest. If you live in our family, you don't grab for it, you're not going to get it. But you want it, something to eat? Survival of the fittest. Cousin of Charles Darwin, Francis Galton, biologist, posited what we know as eugenics from Darwin's theories. That it has to do with the idea of selective breeding, of purifying the race. And he said, what is necessary in the world today is eugenics. We have to purify the human race by selective breeding. Do you see how radical this is getting? 1920, sometime after that, an American nurse by the name of Margaret Sanger took Galton's suggestion and applied eugenics widely across the United States and ultimately around the world. She wrote a book, Women and the New Race, from Darwin's postulates, and there argued against reckless breeding of the unfit. Chapter 5 in that book was titled The Wickedness of Creating Large Families. Well, how many of you are guilty? And in my mind, I revisit that conversation with that educated couple who have learned and fed on these kinds of philosophies. No wonder you're looked on with disdain. Are those all your kids? Nope. I don't know that one. Depends on what day, right? The Wickedness of Creating Large Families, Chapter 5. There she argues the most merciful thing a large family does to a new child is to kill it. What an awful idea. From an icon of that era, Margaret Sanger. It's better to have a society of 1,000 thoroughbreds, she wrote, than a society of 1 million runts. Who are the runts? The unfit? In her mind, it was the blacks, the Hispanics, the Indians, the Catholics. The fundamentalists, of all things, were noted by her. Whoever those guys are we fundamentalists? Who could oppose the obvious, in her mind, what needed to be done? She created the Negro Project in the southern United States, which ultimately caught the attention of John D. Rockefeller, as I mentioned later, in his population project. Her methods? Contraception, sterilization, and abortion. In favor of sterilizing imbeciles and criminals and the institutionalized poor was then Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was quoted as saying, "It is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crimes committed, or letting them starve for their imbecility, it is better that we prevent these who are manifestly unfit from reproducing their kind." Supreme Court Justice of the United States of America of that era. Margaret Sanger developed what was known as the Birth Control League. She set up clinics broadly, not only around the United States, but across the earth, ultimately, that have come to be known as, anybody know the name of them today? Planned Parenthood. Which brings us to the recent history here. 1972, Roe versus Wade. Abortion on demand is the law of the land. And that in favor of women's rights. Not any rights of women, but which rights? Reproductive rights, which is a misnomer in my opinion, because it's not reproduction, it's deproduction that we are upholding in this case. You and I know the tragic statistic from that time, some 40 plus million abortions have occurred in the United States, an estimate of over a billion abortions worldwide in the last 75 years, over 1 billion people. 40 million, that's the population of the state of California. Many of those people would have been in their 30s and 40s and 50s today, and they are absent from planet Earth, thanks to this heinous philosophy. 2016, Harvard social biologist Edward Wilson wrote a book, Half Earth, Half Earth. He suggested that the Earth cannot handle what it's being handed here. It is beyond carrying capacity as it is. We are at that point, the tipping point of the Earth. He said it would be possible, or it could be possible, to sustain maybe 10 billion people if everyone were vegetarians. But he says, as it stands, we're going to need another Earth. We're going to need a second planet. Maybe that's part of the premise or the push to send people to Mars. Got any neighbors you'd like to send to Mars? Sign them up for the next trip. He said, we will run, his predictions are we will run out of potable water and within the next 17 years. Now, that was back in 2016 that he wrote the book. So we are edging up on that time, according to this scientist. What are his suggestions? We need a technological evolution, and everything must go green, green energy, so that we can lower our impact on planet Earth. Number two, we need fewer forks on planet Earth, fewer forks, as he calls it. We need to reduce the human population, possibly by, as some estimate, as much as 30%, to be at a point of sustaining ourselves, healthy population level. And thirdly, we need better manners. We need to get along with one another. We need to unify now, bring the world together with such a dire situation at hand. Fewer forks, biologists call that thinning the herd, thinning the herd. We use hunting here in Branch County to do that every year, don't we, to thin the herd. And if hunting doesn't do it, your car does, car bumpers, almost as effective. How have they suggested we thin the herd? Well, we all know birth control, number one proponent of it. Abortion, we are looking at Proposition 3 here in Michigan, with the reversal of Roe versus Wade. Have you read this? Well, you need to. It's out on the lobby table out there. Grab one of these. We'll have more available next time. Very concerning. At risks, if Proposition 3 passes in the ballot box in Michigan here in November, we will lose parental consent for abortions if this law goes through as posited. There'll be a ban on school employees helping children have abortion, or it'll stop the ban on school employees. Laws requiring parental consent for medical treatment related to pregnancy, including sterilizations and hormone therapy, are at risk. At risk are late-term abortion bans. At risk is screening for women who are being coerced to have an abortion. At risk is the health and safety requirements for abortion facilities, requirements that only doctors perform abortions, conscience protections, protections for doctors and nurses who object to having abortions are also at risk, conscientious, I should say. Ban on tax-funded abortions, Michigan's original 1846-1931 abortion law will be banned. And bans on statutory rape and incest. You need to read this and you need to do your homework, because this is what we will decide as a state. And as bad as Roe versus Wade was it, and as our state legislature over the years has edged up to, slowly nipped away at the abortion industry and abortion laws in Michigan, we could stand to lose all that if we lose the vote here in November on Proposition 3. Thinning the herd, birth control, abortion, sterilization. Boy, sex changing. Transgenderism, I think, is exactly that. What we're finding is regret in numerous people who have made the sex change and find themselves sterile for life. Euthanasia, better named assisted suicide, now practiced in some 9 states in the United States, primarily the East and the West Coast. If you're traveling, make sure you don't get in a serious accident on the West Coast or the East Coast, because they may have the power to pull the plug on you. And so we join Canada, the Netherlands, Holland, Sweden, other developed nations who stand strong in euthanasia as a tool to thin the herd. Natural disasters help. There's an applause every time there's a hurricane or an earthquake by this population of people. But they only do limited damage. Some 45,000 people a year, it is estimated, will die from natural disasters. War is a much bigger punch. Potentially millions could die. World War II, some 9 million. World War I, some 9 million. World War II, some 16 million people died in war, assisting in this dramatic problem of overpopulation. Diseases, 1918 flu, some 35 plus million, an estimate, people died from the flu. The AIDS crisis, although we don't hear much about it anymore, some 40 million people have died from AIDS. Some 30 million people currently are HIV positive. Starvation, typically the result of war. In fact, disease and starvation almost invariably follow war wherever it goes. COVID-19, boy, what are the estimates? 6 million worldwide that have died from COVID. Necessary agent used routinely by Mother Nature to thin the herd, disease. And here's one that's provocative to me. In fact, I've asked Dr. Fuchs if he would speak partially to this in medical science, kind of as it relates to this theme afterwards today. And if you're able to stay, we'll have coffee next door. Why don't you join us for the discussion? I think he's got some interesting input for us, possibly some question and answer time as well. But bioweapons are really, I think, of recent interest, not only because of what we're discovering about these labs, but as a tool to thin the herd, to lower the population of the earth. How many of you remember back around 9/11, there are the anthrax scares, the envelopes with anthrax. As I recall, some 20-plus people were infected by anthrax. 5 people actually died from it, a couple of senators, number of people, government officials, members of the media who were targeted with anthrax. Well, what we're finding out about these biolabs is disturbing because of the nature of the research that's being done there. It's called gain-of-function research. We've all heard of it, haven't we? And if you, and again, Doc, I think you can probably help us understand technically more about what that means. But if you take an agent, you take a bacteria or a virus, and you can amplify its lethality, and you release that on the population, as the question has routinely been revisited, is that what happened with the coronavirus? Build up in a lab. Gain-of-function research, as we're finding the trail, apparently funded by the NIH in some form or fashion, implicating Francis Collins, University of North Carolina, as well as Tony Fauci. Boy, that is a troubling concern, isn't it? That possibility. And in fact, the bioweapons that we have yet to discover that exist in different places of the earth, whose primary function, or one of their primary functions, is to develop bioweapons that can be used against populations of people on the earth as a potential tool to thin the herd. Now, there is an opposite argument that I'd just like to breach here for a moment and then finish up. And that is, in fact, that the earth is in trouble not for overpopulation, but for depopulation. And in fact, is possible to occur, it could be possible that we could see occur a population collapse. I picked up a book a number of years ago, I don't know if it was Grodzo, where I saw it, Fewer. The book was called Fewer, written in 2004 by a man named Ben Wattenberg. And he has trailed the birth rates since the 1950s, and this campaign, as I suggested, really launched this depopulation campaign, and has determined that birth rates are falling dramatically worldwide. Two dozen nations at the moment, he suggests, are on course to see their populations halve within this century. Of the 195 nations, 180 are already at or below replacement rates. The replacement fertility rate is 2.1 children per couple, 2.1, because you need more in case the child doesn't survive childhood or does not marry and procreate. Anybody know what the fertility rate of the United States of America is today? I think impartial resultant of all this campaigning, 1.7. Britain is a little ahead of us there, 1.65. France, 1.8. But France, they posit the birth rate to the presence of such a high population of immigrants as possibly skewing those numbers. Of the 45 developed nations, all but one, here's a trivia question for you, what nation has a birth rate today of 3 children per couple? Israel. They have a different mentality about their generations, about life on earth. They have a sense of, Orthodox Judaism has a sense that there is a purpose, a point to life, and a calling, and a destiny as people of God. They don't buy what everyone is feeding. China, obviously, one of the lowest, 1.3 children per couple, fertility rates. This is creating a whole new set of problems for societies. Economic growth is tied to population growth and productivity. Growth signifies health. It always has. National growth due to three factors. Our nations are growing, I should say, due to three factors. Where there's low fertility rates, people are living longer. So we're counting them, recounting them annually, and they haven't died. Immigration. Boy, 20% of the United States workforce is having to be supplemented by immigrants because we don't have the manpower. Where are they to fill those roles? Immigration, people living longer. But the toll it's taking on the senior population, Social Security, what is it, 1/4 of our federal budget? There are not the replacement workers to pay the future Social Security as we see ourselves going broke as a nation. The malaise hanging over the United States workforce, what we've discovered or are discovering is that the workforce ages 25 to 55 are undergoing a significant season of depression. There's a sense of lost hope in society. And for good reason, people aren't interested in bringing children into the world. Invariably, birth rates fall when people lose hope. World War I is a good example of that. The era of World War II, the Great Depression. And they rise where there's a renewed sense of purpose in society and in the world. But the fact of the matter is many people have low expectations. They've been fed this kind of information. And having kids is no longer the enriching, rewarding, fulfilling venture that it once seemed to be. People technically today are more interested in personal affluence and autonomy. It's an apathetic attitude that abounds. And I think it's a result and effect of a worldview gone wrong. It really, this boils down to, and I finish here, with a worldview war. It's the way that you see the world. On one side, you have naturalism. You erase the idea that there is a God or there is a supernatural. There's only nature, naturalism. On the other side, you have theism, those who believe in a God. On the nature side, the world is accidental. It is hanging in the precipice. It's on a delicate balance. The earth is fragile and frail. We have to be careful. Is the theme that's repeated over and over from that stance. On the other, on the side of God, he is creator, sustainer, and redeemer of the earth. In the beginning, God created the earth. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, Psalm 24:1. It's his job to manage the universe. And the universe is not frail and fragile. It's rugged and resilient and robust. It's demonstrated that over and over and over with all these predictions of all the tragedies that would occur and all falling short on a worldwide scale. I love God's promise to Noah, and I want to finish up here this morning. Genesis chapter 8, if you have a Bible and want to go there with me. These words ought to give you comfort and encouragement, but they ought to energize you to speak up. When you hear similar kinds of things being said, or perhaps when you are cited as being irresponsible and uncaring for the earth. Genesis chapter 8, verse 22, it's God's promise to Noah, but it's called the Noahic Covenant. It's a covenant that he makes with Noah and his generation and succeeding generations, you and I included. Notice his words there. As long as the earth endures, God tells Noah, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night, will what? They'll never cease. We just sang the song and we're going to finish with it. This is my Father's world. He's in charge. Not us. Now, we are stewards, granted. We have been told, as of the Garden of Eden there, Adam and Eve, to be fruitful and multiply. We're trying to do our part. How about you? To fill the earth and then what? Subdue it. Rule over. Manage in God's stead. But the earth is the Lord's, ultimately. And it ultimately is his prerogative to bring it to its intended and final end, as we know God will, in fact, do. We need balance here, biblical stewardship. And it is required of a steward, the Apostle Paul wrote, that he be found. We ought to be students of the environment, of ecology. But let's do it through the eyes of faith, not through the eyes of fear. Paul told the Thessalonians, test everything, hold on to the good. Don't take my word for it. Do your own homework here. Look things over and come up with a conclusion of what is right and what is true, what is good from God's vantage point. As we saw when we finished this morning from 1 Peter chapter 3, do not fear what they fear. Do not be afraid, Peter writes to his audience. But in your heart, set apart Christ as Lord. Have you done that? The Lord Jesus Christ, first in my life. But then he goes on to say, and always be ready to give an answer to anyone who asks you for the hope that you have. He says, do it with gentleness and respect when you do. Lord, we ask you to prompt us this morning. It's a troubled world that we live in. There is so much, truthfully, so much suffering, heartache, pain. But the onus is not humanity per se, it's sin. And you have come to do away with the penalty of sin, the power of sin, and ultimately the presence of sin. And the world's Savior is not science. It's Jesus Christ. So, Lord, I pray for myself and I pray for each one of us as we wrangle with the news that abounds from so many angles. We hear these dire and desperate reports. Help us to affirm the truth of your promise in Scripture given to Noah of old that stands for today, long as the earth endures, until you say it's time. Seasons will continue according to your plan. But make us stewards, and more than stewards, make us evangelists. Give us a message to speak, as Peter says, to speak up when people want to know why we see it differently and share the hope that you've given us. It's our prayer this morning. We ask it in Jesus' name.
Thank you for spending time to listen to today's podcast, Design for Life. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, let me encourage you to donate to this ministry. you will find a donate tab at BethelGilead.org. Until then, go out and experience the design for life as God's ambassadors commissioned to a world in need of the gospel. God bless.